beautiful people, and welcome back to the Let It Flow podcast. My name is Taryn, and I am your host here on the Let It Flow podcast. As you may know, there have been a lot of changes lately, and I am now hosting this podcast on my own, as well as a bunch of other things that have changed and shifted and taken new form, and I'm really looking forward to being back on here and sharing with you again. In the meantime, I am so excited that you have joined me today, because this episode is simply a can't miss episode. I had the chance to sit down with Tejal and Jaisal of the Yoga is Dead podcast, which is a podcast that has been truly transformational and has changed and shifted my perspective and my awareness of my yoga practice, my yoga teaching, and my sensitivity to the practice itself, but also just to life in general and how I'm interacting with other people, with other cultures, and the true implications of all the actions, the words that we speak, the things that we do. So this podcast is something that I could not recommend more highly. If you haven't yet, seriously, go ahead and check out the Yoga is Dead podcast, because these two beautiful, amazing women really speak for themselves. With that said, Tejal and Jaisal are two yoga teachers who have teamed up to create this podcast, and I'll let them tell their own story, but they have so many interesting things to say about what yoga is like from the perspective of an Indian American woman teaching and their experiences teaching yoga in the Western world, despite the fact that it has such deep ancient roots in South Asian culture. So their perspective is something that I think is as valuable as gold, especially in this day and age. And I'm so happy that you're here with me. Really take this time, listen to this podcast, turn it all the way up, and just let it all sink in, fully embody this. Thank you for being here, and I'm so excited to share this with you. Hello, Tejal and Jaisal. Thank you so much for joining me today and coming on my podcast. Your show, the Yoga is Dead podcast, has inspired so much change in my own life and in my practice, as well as my teaching, and was actually shared with me by a fellow yoga teacher who was on both of my yoga teacher trainings, and she had a similar experience with your podcast. Everyone I've spoken to has been like, they say things that I think I knew in the back of my mind, but when they say it, it completely changes my perspective because I'm faced with all these facts. So your show is absolutely amazing, and I'm excited to have you here.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
Before we begin, I would love to kind of just open up the space for you to introduce yourselves and share with the listeners who you are and what you do.
Yeah, it's always such a big question. My name is Tejal, and I teach yoga. I started about 5 or 6 years ago. Can't really remember. And I teach group and private classes. I also teach community classes for people of color. I run workshops and retreats. I run the ABCD Yogi community, which stands for Any Born Conscientious Desi Yogi. And to be Desi is to have roots in South Asian diaspora. Doesn't mean you live there now, but just that you have some connection back to it through your roots and your lineage. And that's really a community for healing within the South Asian community, and also a space for learning for anyone who's interested to learn and learn more about ABCD yogi practitioners. I'm part of the Living Now Yoga prenatal teacher community, and I offer prenatal classes. I volunteer with the Lineage Project in New York, which is an organization that offers trauma-conscious mindfulness practices to vulnerable or at-risk youth, whether that's in foster care or city housing or detention centers or alternative to incarceration centers. And that organization also trains leaders in all spaces about mindfulness. And then, of course, I am co-host of the Yoga is Dead podcast.
Jaisal here. So I have a personal brand called Yoga Walla, and through that brand, I teach private yoga classes. I have one group class, and I do movement education currently through my social media, and then it will be through my website as well, and in teacher trainings. I am on staff at Mahamama Prenatal Training, and I'm also part of that community and offer by donation classes through that community offering. I am the co-creator of the 19 Women of Color to Watch in 2019 list, and we will be doing a 2020 list of all teachers. So 20 people of color or yoga teachers of color to watch in 2020 will be the upcoming list. I'm also a volunteer with World Spine Care Yoga Project, and it's a nonprofit organization that teaches folks, low mobility folks rather, to use yoga as a tool for pain management and prevention, and just helps them get a little bit more mobile and have a little more access to their bodies. And yeah, just like Bajal, I'm the co-creator of the Yoga Zit podcast. Woohoo. Yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I'm curious, and I know you mentioned it in your own podcast episodes a bit, but what events or certain things happened in your life that kind of began you down this road of bringing consciousness into your yoga practice, but specifically with the podcast?
Jaisal and I met in 2015, and that is actually when I first started to teach yoga, I had quit my other jobs. I thought, okay, I'm going to full-time teach yoga, not having any understanding of what that meant, like what kind of hustle that really was. But then that's when I, you know, started the hustle of teaching yoga as many places as I could find, creating programs, donation-based programs. And then I realized there was kind of a gap in my teacher training education that I had, several years prior in and around New York City for my 200 hour. And then I had recently just taken my 300 hour in India in an ashram for an advanced hatha yoga training. So when I came back and I started to like really try and get a lot of teaching work, I realized for me, I wanted to bolster my kind of like functional anatomy knowledge. I didn't think that I had gotten a lot of that, even in the 500 hours of yoga training. So Jaisal and I met at a 100 hour functional anatomy training. And I think we very, very soon into that training realized that we were in some uncomfortable situations, and we had to really like investigate why we felt so uncomfortable. And we had each other to talk that through. And so then the years passed and we still had each other to talk through any uncomfortable situations, support each other in our yoga work, and just like be friends, that I then pitched this idea of, let's have a podcast, because even though we're friends and we support each other, there might be some things that we think about the yoga world that we don't necessarily agree on. And so Jaisal and I sat with that idea for a while, and we realized like, wait, we do have some conversations that we want to share with the world, but how can we make them really productive and useful? And blah, blah, blah. The story becomes this podcast, which is like a beautiful effort of our not so positive experiences and thoughts and critiques about the yoga industry, but hopefully we package them in a way that is compelling and then allows people to like maybe do more in a different way to kind of elevate and uplift the yoga industry.
In your personal opinions, what are some of the most, I guess, glaring myths or misconceptions about yoga that are widely accepted by the public? So specifically people who maybe don't know too much about yoga or don't have a practice, like what are the stories that you think are the most widely spread?
Well, the first and biggest misconception, especially here in the West, is that yoga is just physical fitness, and that it's just asana. And obviously, if you've delved into yoga at all, you know that it's a spiritual practice and that physical fitness is not the end goal of the practice. So I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions that's out there in the public. And then I think there's a couple of other misconceptions, but one of them being that yoga, the purpose of yoga is to feel good. And I think yoga is a tool that can help you to feel good, but that is not the purpose. The purpose is this self-actualization, this union with the greater source of energy, with yourself, to integrate that union within yourself and to the world around you. And often that process can be really ugly, can be deeply uncomfortable, it can be painful. So while yoga at times can make you feel good, that's not like you're not always going to feel comfortable because of your yoga. Yoga is going to push you, right, to change and to grow and to be a better person. And then I think the lack of understanding out there regarding, you know, how the difference between like a yogi that goes to the mountain and renounces all worldly possessions versus yoga teachers in day to day that live their everyday household or life. That's like a big area of misunderstanding and lack of knowledge and what the difference is between that. And I think it translates into the yoga industry with this conflation of spirituality and business and all of these other elements of everyday life that we as householders have to deal with. So it creates a lot of confusion around how yoga should be practiced or how yoga is distributed and all of those things. So I think that if we have like a clearer understanding of the roots of yoga and how there is a difference between a renunciate and a householder, we could clear up a lot of these common misconceptions.
Yeah, and your podcast is really kind of serving that purpose.
Yeah, we do talk about that a lot, especially in our Seva and Karma episode, where we talk about the different, you know, what Seva is and what Karma is and how that's being misused in the industry, right?
Yeah, I love that episode.
Yeah, and I think another misconception out there that we don't talk about as much, but we're going to talk about in our upcoming episode, is this idea of nonviolence. And to do yoga, you have to be vegan. And so we're going to address that a little bit more. But just to speak to that briefly, you know, ahimsa just translates to nonviolence and non-harming. And so there are many, many ways that we can express that. And it doesn't have to be singular. But I think a lot of people outside of the yoga industry even come to yoga, and or when they think about yoga, they think, oh, you have to be vegan to do yoga. And that's just not true.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's actually something that I've heard before. People have asked me questions about like their diet in relation to yoga. And so that's interesting because that undertone definitely does exist.
Oh, cool. So you'll like our next episode then.
Yeah, lots of people don't. Yeah. And lots of people don't come to yoga, right? Because they're intimidated and think that they're going to be converted into trying, you know, people are going to try to convert them to a vegan. And that's just not how it should be. And not the truth of what yoga is.
Well, yeah, I'm really excited to hear your next episode. And actually, your episode that you posted, Gurus Killed Yoga, I believe that was your second or your third episode?
Your third.
Okay. That one was like a total game changer for me. I think it was just because of how you laid everything out, like almost as a list, like step by step. And it wasn't just this overall feeling of like, there might be some corruption in the yoga world, but you really outlined it and you just kind of said it how it was. And I loved that. And I'm really curious if you could share with listeners kind of where the inspiration for this episode came from. And maybe for anyone who hasn't heard the episode, offer a little bit of a preview of what you kind of
this episode. So just to step back, we planned our season with our six topics, or very close to our six topics from the beginning. So this was part of the conversation where we wanted to talk about, okay, white women killed yoga, and what does that actually mean? It means more diversity and inclusivity. And then other personal experiences we had around pay and contract issues, and that became episode two, Karma Capitalism Killed Yoga. And then we stepped into that conversation where we realized that power dynamic, maybe from episode one, actually goes a little deeper through personal experience, as a misuse of power. And so how can we dive more into that? And we realize that also relates to a misuse of power that can be just misconduct, or that also has been seen as actual abuse. And Jaisal went into a personal story about her stay in the ashram, where literally her entire stay at the ashram, there was six or so levels of different forms of abuse that she experienced while studying yoga. And that was something that really stuck out to us. But without going deep into just her personal experience and potential trauma through that experience, we zoomed out to the yoga industry. And so this episode talks about lineage holders and what's the really popular names and teachers that practice yoga and then educate others and offer trainings in yoga that actually have these really storied pasts around abuse and misconduct. And knowing that abuse and misconduct isn't uncommon, it's not, sadly, that the Me Too movement really created like this importance and elevation around that conversation. But then realizing that yoga wasn't actually different. It was also part of that conversation. And we started to realize like we're seeing posts and articles sharing about abuse that people experience through their yoga teachers, through their yoga teacher training. But somehow those abusers were still upheld as leaders in the yoga community. And so we use the podcast as an opportunity to really go deep into the mindset that maybe created that dissonance. So the yoga philosophy that might state you should be devout to your guru, you should find a guru and unquestioningly follow him. Or is there other literature that says you should have a guru, but also some other awareness around your autonomy? And so we use a podcast as a way to go deep into that philosophy that is differing. You find that philosophy and the texts usually contrast each other so that there might be different ways to interpret the language. And that we kind of allowed it to be a way to talk about how to have more freedom of choice rather than fit into a strict logic that you may have been taught is the only way. And then through that podcast, through that episode, I mean, it was exhausting. Like, I'll just want to say personally for the both of us that the work for that episode was exhausting on a different level because it was emotionally and mentally taxing. And we found that when we were talking about these, you know, potentially triggering topics, it was really hard to get through that material. Like, we would just be so exhausted after talking through it in meetings, especially after recording. We did actually two rounds of recording. The first round, it was like we needed quiet time afterwards and like really like deep moments of care. And then we realized when we actually recorded that episode, like the way we dealt with it was a little bit through like nervous laughter and nervous giggling, just to have like an energy outlet throughout that process of recording that episode. So, I mean, that was a really powerful episode, I think personally for us, but I hearing you, Taryn, too, I think it was also pretty powerful for you. And when we were researching and asking the community their thoughts about it, there was even more that we couldn't fit into the episode based on listener stories and other like more localized situations of misconduct and abuse. So that's what that episode is about. Maybe have maybe create a little space for yourself to listen to it when you do get there.
I'm curious also, Taryn, you said that it changed your life. In what ways did it change your life?
It's interesting because I've tried to kind of explain the backbone of your episode to people because I'm like, my perspective on yoga is really shifting. Like, here's one thing that has changed it a lot for me. And it has been hard for me to fully grasp what it is that it shifted. Honestly, as a teacher, I haven't had any, well, there's never any comparison to be made between one person's story with another, but I haven't had the worst experience of abusive power, but I have been in situations where the person that I'm looking up to as a leader in the yoga community is completely mm-hmm. abusing power with myself and others. And I've had that whole like disenchantment thing of watching this person that you thought was supposed to be the representation of the thing you love most, of yoga. They're supposed to be the one most connected with the practice, who are telling you how to get there and how to raise your vibration and be better. And then all of a sudden you start to kind of see behind the curtain and there's like this ego involved and there's this personal gain. And all of these things that don't live up to the message that they're sharing. And to watch that happen and then see myself and others end up in situations where they felt kind of wounded and almost sucked dry, be it financially or be it emotionally, or they feel like they were really brought down to like a substandard level by a teacher who needed to kind of prove that they were above. That's something I've experienced too. And within that, also some abusive situations have been wrapped up, I guess, in a lot of my yoga experience. But hearing that, it really clicked something within. Like, there was this, I don't want to say like this trigger, but this moment of realization of, wait a minute, I align personally with my own story, but also my soul and my heart goes out to and connects with the victims. Not, I don't like that word, but the people who have been put in these positions where somebody in power is using, especially a spiritual practice, to almost oppress others and hold them down and say, this is my personal will, this is my purpose, this is what I'm going to do, and you just have to be almost a pawn in my game. And I realize that I connect a lot more with the people who are in those situations where they are being abused, because most of the time it's one person abusing many others. And that's the voice that I want to speak for. That's the message I want to share. I don't want to just be mindlessly preaching words of gurus without at least knowing the backstory of why and who else is involved and what other perspectives are there and what's my own perspective. And so it really started me down this road of like, teaching yoga doesn't mean I have to be
word for word sharing, right?
What came from another lineage.
Yeah, that's so beautifully put. Yeah.
It's really liberating to hear it all laid out that way. And I hear that it was exhausting, and I'm sure that it was super exhausting. So I kind of hate to ask, but would you be willing to maybe give us like a little bit of what you mean when you say like, yeah, the abuse of power?
ESPN does a 30 for 30 like deep dive podcast, and they decided to devote one of their seasons to Bikram Choudhury about his abuse of power and his misconduct within Bikram Yoga. And they devoted six episodes to it. They had a full-on story about it. And so we kind of just used his name and a few of the examples from his trainings along with like many other leaders. But he's a really good example. Good is not the right word to use, but it's a very strong example of misusing power and privilege, and then also exercising your willpower over others to put them in compromising situations, to make them feel unsafe, gaslighted, where they don't even believe their own reality anymore because you've exercised your will over them so strongly, and confused people between what's what. And also it's an example of where entire communities stayed silent when they knew there was abuse going on. So that's one like big, very public example.
I'm going to chime in with another example that isn't as prevalent, and that is the Ruth Lara Manetti example. And she's a lead teacher at Jiva Mukti who was accused by one of her her instructors, like that would study under her mentees, of abuse. And you can read all the details about it. It's out there in the news. But the reason I want to point this example out specifically to is it, often when we think of abuse, we think of these like big, kind of big bad men, and often even big bad South Asian men or Asian men. You know, if you're talking about different like Buddhist lineages or something like that. But really, the episode really even like kind of ties well together with the White Women Killed Yoga episode for us too, because exactly what you were saying, Taryn, about you looking up to like a teacher or a mentor and then finding out that you're actually just a pawn in their game, or that they don't really care about you as much as they say they do, and you go through that disillusionment. Thejal and I felt that so many times through our experiences in the yoga industry, on like maybe not on a guru level, like a big, like a Bikram, but maybe on like a Ruth Lara Manetti level, like somebody who was a mentor or teacher to us. And so I think that what you're saying, what you said about that is like, it's so much more common to see that. And that tied back into our White Women Killed Yoga episode. That's exactly why we did that episode first, because we had so many experiences where I had, like in my teacher training, I did a 300-hour training. And I'll just say, like, I felt so gaslighted by the end of that training that the teacher was telling me on the one hand that this was a mentorship program, they wanted to support me, this, that, and the other. And then out of the blue, something clicked and they just decided they didn't like me, and they didn't like make eye contact with me for the rest of the training or talk with me or follow up with me. And then same thing with where Thejal and I met in that 100-hour yoga anatomy training. Like, those teachers were supposed to be leaders. They were supposed to be our mentors. They were supposed to hold themselves up to like a certain standard. And instead, they they did exactly what the gurus do, right? They oppressed us. They gaslighted us. They made us feel like somehow we were in the wrong. And they convinced us that it was our fault. As opposed to, you know, people have asked us, like, why didn't you walk out of that training? It's because we felt gaslighted our whole lives, but also, like, especially in that training, that, you know, you're wrong, and how could you possibly question me? And so that plays out over and over again, which is why another reason I think we felt compelled to do a Gurus episode.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing about Gurus and also the white woman killed yoga. That was actually my next question. So a nice little segue. That episode, of course, was also very touching and shifted a lot of things in my own perspective. And it's kind of funny, I guess it is in a way, like an elephant in the room, because I am a white woman teaching yoga and have been for a little bit. So I would just love to hear, I know you kind of shared a little bit about your experiences in the teacher training, but can you just share how that has impacted your life and maybe what situations you found yourself in with white women in the yoga community that really led you to be like, oh my goodness, this needs to be an episode?
White women often are the dominant group in the yoga industry, right? And so they're often in these leadership positions. They're often in the guruship position, even though they may not be named as a guru. And so we have all these experiences of these power dynamics playing out. And while I named two, like there was one specifically where we didn't know where to place it. And that was the story that Thajal tells in our second episode about around contracts, where a white woman basically tells her, okay, we're on equal footing going into this partnership, but the contract said otherwise. And when it came down to the nitty gritty of it, and the person didn't agree with some of Thajal's actions, they really,
yeah, but I just want to say it wasn't
after
a white woman
for that and sued her, and they were in a lawsuit for 2 years.
It's a layered situation, but
I thought it was a white woman. But there have been other situations like that where even I was in a contract situation with a white woman, and we're like, where do we put this episode or this story? Do we put it in the first episode or the second one? Where again, a white woman was hired me for her training. And we talk about this, I think, in the second episode, but it easily could have been in the first one, where she hired me for her training and I've been working in her training for a couple years. And then she decides that she wants me to sign a contract saying she can record my lecture and then own the copyright to the material of that lecture. Meaning that if I were to then teach my own material somewhere else in another training, she could come after me legally. And I just didn't agree to that, obviously. But that was like another way in which she was trying to exert her dominance over me and like make me feel like, okay, actually you're disposable. And if you don't sign this contract, we're just going to find somebody else, which is exactly what she ended up doing.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Thank you for sharing your story. That sounds incredibly frustrating and just kind of defeating. I honestly give both of you kudos for sticking with your yoga practice and sticking with what you care about in the face of something so uncomfortable and kind of just dirty. It just doesn't feel right all around. So
it's, yeah. And it's so pervasive, sadly. Like I had another incident come up as well where, I was supposed to present at a conference with somebody, and they, again, a white woman who had asserted her dominance over me over and over again and had basically said, oh, I want you to do all the work. I'm not going to be available to do all the work. Oh, and by the way, I'm not sure I agree with your views on whatever, something yoga related, which she didn't even know my views, but I'm not sure I agree with your views. And so you may not, I may not even, the implied messaging was, I may not even have you come and present with me. So I want you to do all the work, but the implication was, I may not actually have you come and present. And so like, I will say through the work of this podcast, you were kind of asking us like how things have changed through the work of this podcast and working through all of those experiences with Thajal as a sounding board. And then through the research that we did in the podcast, like I was able to finally say like, actually, no, that's not how it's going to be. And like stand up for myself and have the critical conversation that needed to happen in order to make this situation change and be a different outcome than what it's been over and over again.
I want to talk a little bit about that contract
Thank you, Jason,
situation and then the lawsuit that happened. for me, it was jarring on many reasons, because who's suing people over yoga? This wasn't about like injury. This wasn't about actual money that was put into something. It just was about yoga and our methods of like working towards our yoga. And, you know, although it wasn't a white woman, Jaisal had mentioned like the dominant culture and wellness. When you do have a dominant culture, it's not just isolated to that one group, because it's also a mentality of exerting dominance. It's also a mentality of how to exist with power and authority in a capitalistic structure and how to maintain that power and authority. So things get really layered, and a lot, and we've branched out of, through this podcast, we've started doing work around appropriation and a workshop around appropriation. And we get to talk about that a little bit more, but, it's like white women is a phrase, and there are actually, yes, white women that are kind of like the gatekeepers in the main issues that we talk about in episode 1, 2, in a lot of the episodes. But it's also the mentality around maintaining a power structure that you feel entitled to, and what that means, like how that plays out in all of your actions. So we've started to do some work about breaking that down. In essence, like decolonizing that thought process, so you can start to work into a more authentic, authentic, inclusive approach, especially towards yoga and towards other human beings.
Thank you, Tejal. That's so perfect, because that's another great segue. I wanted to ask you in particular how white practitioners can work to decolonize their practice. What are some ways that they can start to get beyond this almost systematic injustice that it's even for those of us who want to be conscious, like we were taught, we were raised, we were taught yoga in a community where this power structure does exist. So what are some ways where we can be conscious of ourselves and make sure that we're not perpetuating it and also calling it out when we witness it?
We're going to give you like a lot of things you can do, The first is naming that power structure and really understanding that, because if you don't understand the power structure in which you're working, it becomes very hard to dismantle it or to decolonize it. And so in this instance, I would tell folks who are listening to really start to understand what is whiteness, because we tend to think of whiteness as the norm and everything else as other. And if you can't recognize, like, well, then what is whiteness? What is everybody else being measured against? It's kind of hard to understand where anyone else is coming from when they say, like, actually, this thing is not other. It's just different. It's just another way of looking at things. So that's a big area of study that you could go and do right away. And then the other couple of things really has to do with learning, being in the seat of the student continuously. So going and learning from non-white authors, teachers, poets, artists, scientists, researchers, dancers, right? Like, we, all of our world is shaped by people who, white people generally, who are elevated to this this level of expert. And Tejal made like a great post about this on our Instagram about like, it's always white people who are elevated as experts and not other people, even though we are also experts in our own culture and our own heritage. And so start to find those people who are expressing that expertise in as many ways as you can find it. And then go make an authentic connection to the community. So with yoga, we're talking specifically about a lineage that was codified in South Asia, right? And so you can go make an authentic connection to the South Asian community nearest you. And South Asians are the second largest immigrant group in this country after Mexicans. We are everywhere across this country. And we've created community centers, temples, you know, and so businesses and so many other ways that people can come and learn about who we are and what our life experiences. And so one of the things we talk about with appropriation is like, you can't just experience culture from your seat of comfort at the studio, the white owned studio, right? You have to really go understand what it's like and how the people from that heritage are expressing it every single day, every single moment of their lives. So go find all of that information out. And then understand why those people don't feel comfortable coming to your classes. Like, why? Look around you and see who's not showing up, and then go find out why they're not showing up in your spaces, right? See, learn ways that you can make them more comfortable. And that's going to take some digging. That's going to take some research. It's also going to take authentic human connection to people, and really you know, seeing what it is, they may not be able to articulate why they feel uncomfortable, but in a meeting, you might be able to gauge like, oh, maybe I need a translator there or somebody who speaks their language and English fluently, or maybe I need, you know, for people who are gender non-binary, maybe we need all gender or not gender non-specific restrooms, or maybe we need to provide chairs and we don't currently provide chairs. And then maybe we need to train the staff up on how to use these things, or maybe we need to honor the land on which we're practicing. And maybe that's driving away the indigenous population because there's nothing honoring the land on which we're practicing. And maybe there's nothing in the class that's acknowledging the roots and giving gratitude to the roots of the practice and the teachings. So all of these things we can do to work on understanding why people are not showing up and then getting to know why, so what we can do to help them come.
That was an amazing
list. And to
list.
Welcome them.
It continues to pop up once you start doing it, because you see it everywhere you go. You really understand how insidious this colonial mindset is and how it seeps into literally everything, even when you have the best of intentions, and the impact is just ends up being explosive and the response is explosive and harming. But I wanted to add something like, so Taryn, you're actually asking us, like, for a general audience, I think, like, what can white yoga practitioners do? But one of the things I wanted to pull out of this list that might be more personal to you is the honoring of the land on which you're practicing, or like the making connections with the community, because I know you're in Hawaii, and that's like an amazing place to go and visit and just be a part of for a little while, but it's also so rich in indigenous culture, in indigenous and native practices, and the communities that are really struggling sometimes to keep their autonomy. So I feel like this is a great place where you could, you know, also, if you're not already doing it, like, put this into practice too.
No, that's funny you bring that up, because that was the thing that most jumped out at me when Jason was speaking, was the honoring of the land, because that's one thing that I do feel like connects with me personally, because this isn't where I grew up, and this land is very charged and has a long history and people who are still very, very, very connected to it. And it's definitely a sensitive topic. And it's something that even when calling attention to it and honoring the land, it needs to be done with so much care, because you just never want to put the wrong spin on it, or to say something, even meaning to be sensitive, and say it in an insensitive way and still step on people's toes or make people feel unwelcome or like the land itself isn't fully respected or cared for. So it really is such a fine line and such an art form, and something that I have been working on personally, trying to integrate more into my teaching, because it's almost like as powerful as crafting a class itself is, how can you respectfully address everyone in the room? How can you truly hold the space?
You know, and in that, I think it's okay to say, like, you're going to make mistakes. It's okay. You have to, it's not okay to do a lot more harm, but in the name of learning, there are going to be mistakes on that path. And you just have to get started and then just acknowledge when errors come up, because that's part of humanity, right? Where nobody's born perfect knowing everything. And so you don't want to not start because you're afraid of getting it wrong. There was one more thing I wanted to add as well to the whole idea of decolonizing. And this is a question that we've been asking, you know, through our workshops more and more, is people always ask us, you know, what's the difference between appreciation and appropriation? And, you know, we could get into a whole more than 2-hour discussion on this, but one of the things I want people to take away is, if you're saying you're appreciating something from a culture that's been oppressed, what are you giving back, right? If you're not giving anything back, then it's most likely appropriation. Because even in these instances, like, we say, like, oh, you've learned so much from yoga, you've taken so much personally away from yoga, but what have you given back to the community of people that kept these practices alive and sacrificed so much to keep these practices alive for us to use today? And in what way can I support them? And just like you were saying with your indigenous population where you are and how they're struggling, like, you could do that as well. You could reach out to that indigenous population and kind of ask, like, how can I be of service? And in what way am I equipped to be of service? Can I fundraise? Can I spread awareness about certain issues. You know, there's so many ways in which we can do that. So I think asking that question is really key to decolonizing the yoga practice.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Jaisal. Those are all really helpful tips. And it's really, I think for a lot of people, once they start to think about it and specifically listen to your podcast, it can be kind of a hard reality, a harsh reality to face where yoga is today. And I'm curious, just in your personal opinions, do you think that yoga is too far gone? Meaning, I know you both still are teaching and making this podcast, but do you think that capitalism and the modern power structures have tainted yoga beyond it being viable?
Absolutely not. We are using the podcast as an opportunity to take a moment and take a pause and kind of look at the current state of yoga to see that much of what's happening within yoga is actually hurting people and creating separation. And so rather than just moving along in our own lanes and like ignoring what's happening around us within the state of yoga, we wanted to take that pause and then hopefully do something productive around it. So I think what's creating the separation and like kind of hurting people, like to sum it up, is a couple things, like hearing this false narrative that you might have to look a certain way to do yoga. You might have to dress a certain way to get into a class. You might already need to be able to move your body in multiple different ways in order to start a practice. Some of those ideas, they really create this barrier to yoga. And sometimes that barrier is a financial one, like capitalism, and expecting you to buy in to an image in order to start a practice or to maintain or sustain a practice. And it can feel like you need money to like buy into that mainstream misconception. But we don't actually think that it's dead, which is kind of funny. People have gotten a little bit up in arms, like people who don't get the millennial like way of speak. They're like, yoga's not dead. These girls don't know what they're talking about. Yoga is a living, breathing, spiritual practice. So that's always really interesting when we get those people that are just so clear and straightforward about what they think yoga is. And we're like, we get it. We get that. What we're doing is like really hoping to remind folks that the goal of yoga is more connection, not the separation, not hurting people without really paying attention to others. It's actually like more connection. So that's why in our podcast, and we hope we've like really achieved this, it's been so important to you, us, to offer tips and the guidelines on ways to come back to yoga to build stronger, more inclusive, more respectful, and like more in line with ahimsa type of communities and practices. So we really do try to ask people to take time to be introspective about their yoga practice, like listen to what comes up. Make space for those feelings to exist, even if they're not the good ones, quote unquote. And then like really assess whether or not their yoga practice is helping them and others to find more connection.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because the name of your podcast is super catchy and I love it. And I know a lot of people do connect with it, but it's pretty bold and provocative. And what kind of backlash or support have you received from that? Like, what are people saying about your name and your message?
Well, overall, I think the name is received pretty well. People understand that it's a bold statement. Most people understand sarcasm and that this is a sardonic tone. But like Dajil said, it tends to be people who either take themselves or take yoga too seriously, or who are maybe of an older generation and don't really understand like millennials speak, that tend to be the ones that get up in arms about it. And honestly, it tends to also be people who don't listen to the episodes. So people just see the name and then they make a critique about it on social media without actually ever having listened to an episode. And they have no idea what it's about. And I think the name really does convey that this is a critical look and that it's not going to be the love and light podcast that every other yoga podcast seems to be about, but actually we're going to talk about the problems and the issues a little bit more in this one. I think it's divided, but the people who don't get it is a small community and most people tend to get what our name is about.
Going back to the roots of yoga and the lineages and all of that we mentioned with the gurus killed yoga, I know that today it's primarily thought of as a feminine practice or a feminine activity, I guess, especially in the West. But in your opinion, is yoga misogynistic or overly masculine?
No, it's absolutely not. Yoga, it just means union, and it's that union with a greater source, that self-actualization. And so that's equally available to everybody. I think the problem is, like any technology, the use of it can become misogynistic because as humans, we are subject to the culture around us. And so we imbue everything with our own perception and our own cultural baggage that we come with. And so yoga doesn't happen in a bubble either. As you know, so we shape it with our thoughts, and it's sometimes in lineages, it's passed down in that way, or it's passed down dogmatically in that way. But that doesn't mean that yoga itself is a misogynistic practice. And we could even liken this to like coding today and technology, where we have a similar problem where coding itself, there's nothing wrong with coding. Coding is just a mechanism, a tool that we use in order to, do something, to achieve something. But if you have coders who are primarily cisgendered white men, there are implicit biases in the way they can code, right? So they can code things, algorithms in a way that maybe for technology that is supposed to be for the criminal justice system and then has implicit biases against Black people. Does that mean that coding is misogynistic? No. Same thing with yoga. Yoga is not misogynistic. It's just the way that we sometimes employ it as humans.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Thank you. Because it's something that I've considered a lot, actually, personally. I'm like, well, yoga comes from, it was created really with men in mind, and it was practiced by men in the beginning of the practice thousands of years ago. And then with all of the abuse of power, it's like, is this misogynistic or is that just an interpretation? So, yeah.
That's also a misconception that it was created for men by men, that actually lots of women and gender non-specific folks were always practicing yoga and always testing the boundaries of yoga. And the narrative that yoga was created for men by men is actually a Western narrative that was created more along the lines of colonialism. So let's debunk that myth today too.
Wow. So since the very beginning, women have been able to practice too?
Absolutely. And if you've ever gone through that Hatha Yoga Pradipika book, it's a really long book and has some really weird stuff in there. Kind of flip to the back, you'll start to see some references to female-centered practices. So like, I know there are some odd practices around there about, and we'll just quote this, like retaining energy, if you get what I mean. They're referring to sexual energy. Mm-hmm. So they have like male-specific practices, and then there are female-specific practices listed even in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, which goes to show you that there were obviously women practicing yoga at the time, that they were writing about, you know, this is what women do, this is what men do.
Wow. That's great. Awesome. Thank you for sharing that.
Who wrote that narrative? Who said, like, these are the teachers we should be following? So then more and more people trained with those teachers only because that's what they felt they had access to. And then it just became a population of people thinking that that was the way it was done. But it does take a little more work to find that non-traditional information or that non-publicly and easily accessible information. But in this day and age where we can access information through a click, it's not actually as hard to access that information, to debunk those myths, to look into it. And we've spoken to people who have practiced through the mother line in their families for as long as they can remember. It's unbroken. So, I mean, yeah. And that's, I heard it in your voice, Taryn, correct me if I'm wrong, but it felt like really empowering to hear that. And it felt the same way for me too. Like, wow. Like, that's really awesome to hear.
Matrilineal.
Like, of course it's not sexist, you know, it never felt like that to me, but it seemed like it based on what I was learning.
And I think that a lot of that myth comes from the story of Indra Devi. I think because of the marketing around Indra Devi as this like beacon woman who broke down gender barriers, the narrative has become no women practice before Indra Devi. And that's not true. She broke down a barrier with a specific group of people where the teacher was reluctant to teach women, but he was, you know, there were women already practicing. Just, I think Vivekananda was like 20 years, probably older than Krishnamacharya was. And in his sangha, his group, there were several women practicing. And so that was around the same time frame. It's just that people didn't take that lineage into the West. And so that narrative didn't fit nicely.
It's a repeated offense that happens over and over in different areas and industries. So it's kind of cool we get to talk about it right here and take and like just remove it.
No, clearly it's very deeply rooted because I was still coming from that place. And it's so interesting to really backtrack and say, wow, well, I thought that was true. That, where did I hear that the first time?
And actually like tracing back the root of where these thoughts or histories or practices came from, it's not really that straightforward. And sometimes it's hard to do on your own. And something that's been really incredible is all the hours of just thinking and wondering about these things that Jaisal and I have put in. Like, it's helped us to trace back like where these things kind of came from. And that is brings so much more clarity to the podcast, to the work that we put into the podcast and to the outcome of each episode. So it's really valuable work. And if you can find like, maybe it's a sangha for you, maybe it's other people that will sit with you and like start to talk about their experiences too. And it helps to carve out that narrative of finding the root.
Yeah, definitely. That's really powerful. It feels like a lot of discussions could be had opening up the forum for where we got these stories that kind of are myths that we all believe to the point where we don't even think to question them. It's great. And that's kind of what your podcast is doing in essence, is it's saying, here's all these things that we all just don't even think about because they're so deeply ingrained in yoga culture. Let's talk about the truth behind it, which is what I love about it. It's so honest. So
yeah, that's what we aim to do. It's hours and hours of research too on our part to kind of figure this stuff out for ourselves.
Definitely. It sounds, I'm like, whoa, they had to have like written that down and read a lot of things about that. And they put that all together really beautifully. But yeah, I can tell that you put a lot of thought and planning into it too, which is powerful because that's the missing piece is we don't want people to just be kind of talking out of thin air all the time and just saying things. And this is truth because I think it's truth, but actually here's some facts and let's just talk about the facts and not put our opinion in. That's kind of, I think, where we need to go with a lot of this.
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, social media culture or just media culture in general, the way it is today, it's like an episode every week. And so many people want us to put these episodes out faster. And we wish we could. But, you know, with all the things you heard, you saw the list of all the things we're doing.
Yeah.
In addition to the podcast. And it's like with that and trying to make each episode as well made and well constructed as we try, like it takes time.
Yeah, definitely.
What has gotten stronger in my personal practice is that I've really applied it like off the mat more frequently than ever before. I can attribute the podcast to that a lot, but also in terms of the workshops and other programs I offer, researching and sitting with the concepts that I want to give to the community is really important, but it's actually more important to embody it before teaching it. So I feel like my personal practice has expanded. It's also a mat-based practice, but it's expanded to yoga in more ways. Like, I've experienced, and maybe Jaisal too, but like the ability to have more one-on-one conversations that really take the tips that we put into the podcast into practice. And just like we stopped for a moment earlier to talk about like, well, hey, let's not ignore that you're in Hawaii and that's a place where you can really honor indigenous practices and the land, et cetera, like all these things that we're talking about for the greater population, that could be a one-on-one relationship you can start to build. But same for me, because the podcast is so public, it's such a public forum and a lot of people listen to it, but it might not be all the people that I practice with or teach with or work with. So I still have to recognize where an injustice might be happening, have a one-on-one conversation around it, and really like put that into practice in a loving and kind way. And I have to work on that all the time. The podcast has been able to allow us to share with more people through interviews and workshops, and the number of connections is just growing. And like, now we know you, and you know, we've met a lot of people that aren't even necessarily like-minded, but are interested to learn about things they're not necessarily doing or aware of. And that's a beautiful thing to me. Yeah. And then I know I'm talking a lot about the podcast, but the podcast has really been a vehicle for us to stay connected to the folks that reach out to us through Patreon, Instagram, Facebook, and email. And I have a personal practice, and it's with me and my spirituality and my identity. But my yoga isn't just about me and my energy. So teaching, I interface with so many people, and the podcast now has brought like so many more people into my life, that it's always another opportunity to practice more yoga, more union, and like more intentional care that operates under the least amount of harm. Like, that's really my main goal. Like, how can I practice in the most least harming ways to live my life?
I second all of that. I will say that if you really want to get in touch with your spirituality, create a media vehicle for your opinions and put them out there. No, it's true. It's such a spiritual thing to do, because you have to practice all the things that you've been learning for years and years on the mat, right? Like, non-attachment to the outcome of the fruits of your labor, non-reactivity. so many of these things that we learn on the mat. This is, you know, that phrase from the Bhagavad Gita, skill in action. This is the skill in action. And then I'll add, for my personal practice, something I've always been like a more contemplative person. And for me, a while ago, I thought to myself, you know, I'm teaching these asana classes, I'm teaching, meditation here and there, I'm teaching all these limbs, but how do I get people who are in my orbit to start to be more contemplative? And so one of the things I do when I have time, less and less lately, but you know, it was more frequent, is to write these newsletters to my community about everyday ways in which I find myself in these like yogic conundrums, basically, right? And so, just to help us to learn that the yoga practice is not just limited to the mat. The mat is a great place to get started, but how can I, when I'm waiting for the subway and I'm already late for the person I'm going to meet, like, how do I then manage my frustration or my anger? Cause that's a yogic conundrum. It's one of those moments where you just want to like scream, but you can't. And so what do you do? How do you deal with yourself? And so I like to write people about my experiences. And that's a way for me in thinking through my own experience and then putting, you know, pen to paper, so to speak. It really helps me to process that for myself. And that's a spiritual practice, just writing. It's like journaling, but for a public forum. And it's like a community. It's like, hey, community, help me process this. So in me writing to you, it's a spiritual practice. And then the other thing is like, I think Tejal feels this way too, but we don't have just, our physical practices are not just limited to like the asana practice that you would see typically in a studio or a mat. And so I personally like to take my mat practice into like the gym with me. So when I'm running, I'm constantly like, okay, try to control the breath here, because that's a problem, or it's an area of difficulty that I've always had. So for me, it's like a deep pranayama practice and a deep focus practice. And so I think in those ways, I still really practice quite fully. If you're talking about a mat practice, it doesn't happen as often as I would like, but probably at least weekly, right? It's more like Tejal said, an embodying practice. How do I embody all the things?
That's great. I love that you mentioned taking it off the mat, because I think that that's really important, and that right there is a common misconception. That yoga has to be practiced on your mat, mm-hmm. and also that your yoga is confined to the time that you're on your mat, and really bringing it off the mat and into things like your workout, but also into difficult situations when you're running late or things like that. really living your yoga.
It's your therapy sessions, right? That's like yoga for me.
Definitely. What would you say to somebody who is interested in starting a yoga practice right now, today? Where would you direct them?
I don't know if I'd direct them to a specific place because each person is so unique, and that finding the teacher for you and the class for you or the modality for you is going to take time. And so I would say just take your time and start slow and know that there's lots and lots of variety out there. Because I think what happens, what I hear most often about people who don't do yoga is like, oh, I did yoga once. I went to a Bikram class and I hated it and it wasn't for me. And so I'm like, okay, but Bikram yoga is very specific. That's not, you know what I mean? That's not like a universal stand-in for all of yoga. There's many, many ways that yoga is expressed. So take your time, do some research, you know, dabble a little bit. And then know also that yoga isn't just a physical fitness class. So if you're looking for a yoga practice, it may not be the yoga class at your local gym. It may end up being like the meditation app on your phone. So I would say those things. And then also, you know, just know that this is a practice with roots in South Asia. And so maybe this is an aspect of that you want to start to explore as well. Again, learning from South Asian perspectives as much as possible, as well as, you know, if you are practicing yoga with roots on other continents, like digging into those roots as well. Or if you want to focus on honoring like the indigenous peoples of where you practice physically, you can dig into those as well. But just looking outside of the perspective that's sort of mass marketed to you. And then I would also just say to people, like, stay a student for a good long time. I think a lot of us take these teacher trainings because we want to immerse ourselves in a yoga practice and then we end up teaching. And not that there's anything inherently wrong with that, but then sometimes it leads us to like become the teacher right away without spending like a good luxurious amount of time as a student in the student seat without that pressure of having to teach. And so I would say, like, just allow yourself time to be a student, because that's where the loveliness is in the studentship of it.
Yeah, that's great advice. I think that's a huge thing, is the teacher training too is very much, well, with capitalism, it's very much marketed. It's like, oh, you're a yoga teacher or you're a yoga student.
But you don't do that in other areas. You don't talk to a university professor and say, oh, you like your job? Well, when are you going to open a new university? When are you going to open up a college? So it's weird that the capitalist structure of doing more and being more and achieving more and amassing more applies to yoga so succinctly. People do that to yoga students, teachers, and business owners so often.
And it's sad, right? Because when you're a business owner, a lot of business owners are having these realizations that actually, once I become a business owner, I can't be in the seat of a teacher or student as often as I'd like. I have to then be in the role of the business owner. Or if you're a teacher, it's harder to sit in the seat of the student as much as you would like, because now more of your time is being dedicated to like this pressure you feel of being an expert. And so it's like, you know, give yourself this, like, the time and the ease to just be a student, because I think that's where the fun is.
Definitely. I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that's such a good point. I'm curious for both of you, are there any new ways to connect with spirituality outside of yoga, or is everything still have yoga as kind of the central theme?
There are, and there have to be, other ways that I feel that. And for me, I could be in nature. Like, most often it could be any place in nature where I'm not seeing other structures in my line of sight. And that always puts me at peace and at ease. But then, you know, we live in a very busy place. We live in New York City. And it's not always easy to take time to do that. You know, the beach is an hour away on the train, but I'm not going every week, even, you know, especially after summer, or I'm not going upstate to go in nature, you know, 2 hours each way all the time. So there have to be other ways, I feel, for me to connect with that too. And Jason and I talk about how releasing our podcast and then managing the response and the workload is an exercise in accessing spirituality. It's an exercise in not falling back into what can be considered like it's inevitable human condition, where you go into this patterning and this loop of performing and working and then you're miserable about it in some aspect of it. Like you could have been excited you got that new job, but then a couple weeks later, you hate the commute, you hate the job, you're in a loop of complaining with your coworkers about, you know, life. And so I think yoga practice helps us to break that loop. And our podcast has been helpful in like doing something new and different, and then trying to stay uplifted in doing the work, trying to apply what Jaisal had said earlier, these yogic principles to the work, like practicing non-attachment, staying resilient around criticisms, not reacting to every single criticism, especially taking a moment to see if it feels harmful to us to respond to criticisms or negative behaviors from others, and to practice really deeply listening to ourselves, listening to each other, and then listening to the community as they go through the process with us.
I will also say there are many ways that I connect to my spirituality. I don't know. This brings up a philosophical question for me. Is it yoga or is it not yoga? I don't know where the line is. You know what I mean? But I'll say activities like, for me, outdoor sport activities like biking. I love biking. That to me is a very spiritual activity because I'm really connecting with my deep self. Or my relationship with my partner is a spiritual activity. And so maintaining that relationship and just being in the presence of each other is very connecting. I adopted a dog earlier this year, and I find like just examining my relationship to my dog. I think lots of dog owners look at their dog and they're like, what are you thinking? And so just in that contemplative work, I don't know, does that fall under yoga because it's so contemplation, but it is contemplative. And it's like, what is your experience and how is that different from my experience? And wow, like the things I take for granted as a human are just not taken for granted in other parts of the, you know, animal realm. And, you know, I wrote a story recently about I took a trip on a safari a couple of years ago, and I was watching these lions just like sitting around for most of the day. They had hunted and they had eaten, and then they were like sitting around and laying around. I'm like, wow, they're not really bothered. Like they don't feel like they need to be productive. They don't feel like they need to do something. Like there's no structure in place that's making them feel bad about what they're doing right now. Just taking a long nap during the day. And like, it really caused me to question, like, what are the structures around me that make me feel so guilty if I want to do that? That make me feel like less than if I want to do that. And so for me, that's like a contemplative practice that falls under yoga, but it's also just connecting with a different being than myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's absolutely a spiritual practice to me. So it's kind of, there's kind of like Tejal said, for us, the podcast is a spiritual practice, but it's also like a creative endeavor. And I think any creative endeavor can essentially be a yogic practice too, and a spiritual practice at that.
Yeah, I guess that's true. The yoga kind of blends in with everything else, and there's not always a distinct line between the practice and not the practice, and connecting and not connecting. Oh my God.
Yeah, and you know, Tejal and I don't have children. I don't think you do as well, no. Taryn, but do you? Yeah, okay. But you know, I've heard from so many parents that their children teach them, and that's like a spiritual journey as well, that like your children change you. That's spiritual transformation.
Yeah, and I just hope we share that knowledge that a spiritual practice or a yogic practice really doesn't rely on the appearance of it. That would be so lovely if our podcast was able to achieve that.
And a step beyond that, like with what we talk about with the social justice aspect of it too, that it isn't just individual, right? It isn't, the spiritual growth isn't just about this individual growth, but like then how can we transform the collective around us?
Definitely. It's all about the community and the connection that you find, not just within, but also in the external world with others.
We give a lot of information, and it might seem familiar and it might seem obvious, but we also get a lot of questions about how can I practically apply it? Because just starting can seem hard, can seem challenging, or can feel really unknown and unfamiliar. But the idea that these things are happening and injustices are happening isn't unfamiliar. So I just like to offer some tips, and many of which we shared at the end of our Gurus Killed Yoga episode, because that's the episode that really relates to, like, I think the abuse, well, what you asked is around abuse within hierarchies and leader follower relationships. So we talk about remembering that no other human being has rights to your body, mind, or spirit. To remember that if you're feeling silenced, gaslighted, violated, to step back, take a moment and reassess, no matter what the perceived costs are, meaning no matter if you think you take that moment, you'll lose the relationship or you'll be penalized. Like, it's better to take self-care in those moments. Practically, it's important to research and keep on hand assault and abuse hotlines. And the leadership at religious institutions or schools should also hopefully have this information readily available. So if you're entering the institution, you're entering a new school, like, hopefully that's part of the onboarding or the welcome packet. But also as the follower, I guess that's the word we're using, or the student, it's important to have that information for yourself to keep your own autonomy and your own control and power within that information. It's good to know who to call if you feel you're in danger, whether it's one of the hotline numbers or whether it's a friend, that someone you can really rely on. And then there's a couple things about the actual behavior. Like, sometimes the unhealthy behavior and the abuse of power comes from the leader, and it's covered up by their charismatic personality, which can prevent people from naming it for so long. But sometimes it can be a bit more gray, and the individual student or the follower, they themselves are dealing with negative situations externally outside of this space, or they themselves are not feeling empowered for whatever reasons. And this is where, in the yoga space and other spaces, the community needs to be more present and aware when they see any potential wrongdoing. So even if you're not the one that is experiencing the direct interaction, you could be experiencing it secondarily or within an entire community. And it's important to call that out when you see it happen. And that's why in our podcast, we talk about how the yoga teacher and the yoga student and the yoga business owners all have a role to play in making the industry a safer place.
I think it's especially difficult when you start to consider, like, how can you mindfully bring this into your studio and into your practice, and also kind of be on the lookout for maybe preventing this for other people too, who might not have the awareness to be able to avoid any sort of abusive power situation. Kind of finding the line between, like, when is it your place to say something, when is it not your place to say something? Because I know a lot of us inherently, when you feel silenced, it kind of trickles into your programming in the way that you want to respond to the world. Even if you think you're doing the right thing, you're just might not want to say something sometimes.
Absolutely. I think also, though, taking that feeling of silence as an alert, right? I think that's the common thing with these gurus or even cults, is this idea that you can't question the leader, and that you can't question this reality, and there's no questioning of anything. And so I think if you feel silence, that's sort of like a big red flag that says, I'm not being allowed to question, and so something is wrong if I can't question, right? And so I think as an industry, this is not like an individual issue, it's like an industry-wide issue. We need to make the culture of the whole industry something where it is normal to question, and it's not, you want, like, silencing someone is not the norm, and that asking critical questions is the norm.
Yeah, definitely. I like that the silence is a good indication. Yeah. Do the two of you believe that yoga needs kind of a general rebrand to promote more empowerment and less of almost like this healing, this position of there's a teacher who knows right from wrong and knows how to heal you, and you need to go to the teacher and go to the specific sequence to be healed? Do you think that yoga needs to rebrand to be more, giving the power to the individual?
I don't love the word rebrand, because it's almost like yoga has always been this set of tools that you're supposed to take and apply to your own life and the way and use your own discernment, right? And there's always been like experimentation within that structure. And so I don't love the word rebrand because I think that there are people out there doing it that. But then I think that the ones that we see most popularly, perhaps even in studios or in gyms, is the dogmatic approach of like, do only as I say. Or like the Simon Says model of vinyasa flow or something like that. And so I don't like the word rebrand, but I would maybe use the word perform. Mm-hmm. Like some of the lineages that maybe are more dogmatic could definitely use some reform. And I think even within those lineages, we see some people trying to do that work. And it's happening slowly but surely. But yes, we do as a collective need to educate our students coming to us from the get-go that actually, I'm not here to solve your life problems. I'm here to give you tools. Because often it's the students, too, that just want, tell me the answer, right? Tell me what to do. And so I think as teachers, we're in this tough position of having to say, like, I'm not going to tell you exactly what to do. I'm going to give you some options, and you're going to tell me what to do, how to lead you, how to guide you.
That makes sense. It's definitely hard to find the balancing point sometimes between the two. And it's difficult because while there are people like the two of you who are doing a lot of work to bring inclusivity and honest conversation into yoga practice, the whole capitalistic, aka the branded, I guess you could say, version of yoga is still that Simon Says kind of vinyasa, like your episode, Vinyasa Killed Yoga, like that kind of,
yeah.
I know the answer. This is what I say. This is what you got to do. And just the culture of the student teacher.
And a lot of programs are like, do what I say so you can see these results.
And I will say that that's not,
which is forcing yoga to be just like a fitness class. And it's happening.
Exactly.
It's not like it's not like there's a big pushback. Like that has already happened. So then you have to like reintroduce the yoga to the student. Which is what Rachel's saying is such a tricky conversation sometimes, because if you're a yoga teacher and that's your job, a lot of the times your priority is on maintaining your students and keeping them with you. And you feel like unless you give them a clear answer, they might walk away and go somewhere else. But really the authentic like student is going to feel connected to you because they have freedom to choose and still realize that maybe what you believe in is practical for them too. We'd like to have a wrap party next year, which would just be a fun way to continue to fundraise, sell our merchandise, and connect with people in person. We've started offering Act Against Appropriation workshops. So we have had two already, and we're hoping to schedule like more than the one that we know is coming next year. We're going to be planning more of those. And then beyond that, we have some interesting ideas that are like pushing us out of our wheelhouse a little bit, but that's also good to break the wheel a little. And we're just like trying to figure out how to be patient with like what's growing exponentially and find the right fit of like what to do with our energy and our time. And personally, it's funny because the priorities just start to shift a little bit. Like right now it's podcast heavy time. We mentioned some projects that we have ongoing at the top of the episode. So for me, with the community that I organize called ABCD Yogi, and you can find them on Instagram through that name.
Absolutely.
It's just a growing community of teachers and people interested in learning from those teachers. So that's been amazing to see and find like international connections with people through that. And the goal for ABCD Yogi is to launch a zine next year, which hopefully is another revolutionary output of creativity and information where South Asian yoga teachers and mindfulness teachers will come together in all the different ways they create, writing, photography, poems, and put together a zine every quarter of next year. And so the next zine the first inaugural zine is an earth-themed issue. So that's something I'm really excited about too.
And in addition to I will be participating with some of those things, the ABCD Yogi. The magazine. And I will be launching the 2020 list next year for yoga teachers of color to watch. And my co-creator, Sophie, and I are going to be thinking about how we can grow that. And I'll be hoping to offer more movement education next year, as well as more business and marketing resources for people in yoga and wellness, because it's, like we said in our second episode, it's a very murky place to operate. So those are some resources that I hope to provide in the next year as well.
Oh my goodness, that's so exciting. It sounds like you've got a lot of work going on.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was a lot of fun. Yes, nice getting do. To meet you.
Can say that again.
Wow, well, that's so great. I am so honored to have had the opportunity to speak with both of you. And I really can't wait to listen to your new episode and follow along with your journey. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Do you have any closing thoughts or anything else that you'd like to share with listeners that you feel like, oh, I want to say this last thing?
You can support us by spreading the news, but also by joining our Patreon for as little as $2 a month, where you can join our Facebook page and our Facebook group chat, where we have lively discussions going on there. We're still really active on Instagram. So if you want to reach out to us and send us a DM, we answer all of our DMs on Instagram.
Wonderful. And your Instagram account is at Yoga is Dead Podcast?
Yoga is Dead Podcast. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful. Great. And Yoga is Dead Podcast is available on iTunes and other podcast hosting sites as well, right?
Yeah, it's available everywhere podcasts are available.
Wonderful. Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing. Thank you for giving all of your wisdom and your insight on your own podcast and for coming on to hear. What you're doing is amazing work. And I really believe that it's the work of the practice, but also just of the people right now in the world. So thank you, Tejal and Jaisal, for everything you do.
Thank you.
Wow. What an amazing interview that was. If you haven't already, seriously, seriously, once you're finished listening to this episode, close it out and find Yoga is Dead Podcast, hit the subscribe button. I promise you will not regret it. They just had an episode come out yesterday, episode number 5, called Vegans Killed Yoga, which I already listened to. It's amazing. I love it. And seriously, if you haven't yet, catch up and listen to all their episodes, take notes, listen to their words, and go ahead and give them a follow on Instagram too. They have a Facebook page and they have an Instagram, which is both Yoga is Dead Podcast. There you can find all of their information and support them and follow along with their journey, because they post a lot of podcast episodes. But if you want to get even more content from them, they're pretty active on their social media pages. So it's always nice to see what they have to say next. Thank you so much for being here. And as always, I am so grateful that you shared this moment with me. Please feel free to reach out if you have any questions. And if you loved this episode and were touched by anything that Tejal and Jaisal had to say, please share it with your friends, with your family, with fellow yogis, or even people you know that are interested in the practice. I hope that you have a beautiful day, a beautiful week. I love you, and I'm so grateful that you were here with me today. I'll talk to you next time on the Let It Flow podcast.